This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Alana Newman, founder of Anonymous Us Project. Conceived as a result of third-party reproduction, Alana asks the question, are there ethical considerations for human reproduction?
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Awesome. Thank you, Star, so much. Thank you, Molly, for inviting me. Do you guys have the slides up yet? So with that introduction, you know a little bit about my story. My mom's first husband was infertile, so to find a solution for their infertility, they did decide to use an anonymous donor to have me. But I also have an older sister who's adopted, and I have a younger half-brother who was conceived naturally with my mom's second husband. So I had a really interesting perspective about the importance of biology. And so I'm going to talk to you about the devastation of third-party reproduction. You guys are familiar probably with the Hans Christian Andersen children's story, The Emperor's New Clothes. Well, I'm going to talk to you about The Emperor's New Kids. So who is the emperor in today's Brave New World? There's a few, but I'm going to talk about the fertility industry. The fertility industry is the authority that is convincing the public that the kids are going to be all right as long as we repeat over and over again that this is normal, this is normal, this is good. But do you guys remember how the story ended? There was a little child in the public square. The emperor came out with his invisible wardrobe, and the little child shouted out, "Hey, everybody, he's naked." And then everybody looked around and they realized that they'd all been fooled. Well, I want you guys to be that brave child who speaks out and just states the obvious and exposes the lies of the fertility industry. Okay, but first, let's have the fertility industry speak for themselves. My husband did an interview with two surrogacy agents from the position of a single dad by choice, and this is what they had to say. If you guys can cue the audio.
If there were to be an issue with a fetus, who has the final decision over a termination, and for what reasons?
Ultimately, the decision will be yours. However, that is very important then to find the surrogate right from the beginning who will agree with your decisions. Let's just say there is an arm missing, yeah? And you then say, I do not want to bring a child into this world with that kind of a handicap, yeah? And you want to terminate the pregnancy. Those things will be established in the contract with the surrogate. Another important part is not just the termination of the pregnancy, but could, for example, what we call a reduction. It can happen if you transfer two embryos. If you only want one child, really only want one child, then you should only transfer one embryo. And because the reduction part, that's a very difficult decision to make. You know,
right.
Because you see,
yeah.
Basically there are two healthy babies growing, but you only want one, and then the decision has to be made, one of those fetuses has to be eliminated,
right.
You know?
So two healthy babies, just because you don't want one, one of them has to be eliminated, right? He interviewed a second surrogacy agent over the question, will my child resent not having a mom? So are mothers important? And this is what she had to say. You guys could cue it.
Is she going to resent not having a mom?
Well, kids are going to be kids. You know, she may go through that stage when she's a teenager, and that's perfectly appropriate. But you're going to be able to handle that. And it's really just, you know, oh, you would have liked to have had come on. You know, I hear you're upset you would like to have come on. You know, I mean, it's just, it's sometimes kids just have to go through that. You know, as you know, families come in all different shapes and sizes now. It's different. So the more that you make everything normal, the more normal it will be for your child. So this is your child's birth story. She was born via a surrogate. This is not her mother. My daddy loved me so much. He didn't want to wait for me. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
So we're at a time and place now where you can terminate a healthy baby just because you don't want it. You prefer not to have two children. And it's okay to dispose of mothers. It's totally fine or whatever. So how do we get to this place? Okay. Well, we're worshiping the wrong things. We are worshiping technology, family and health and beauty, among other things. But let me just start, with a quote from G.K. Chesterton. He says, "The mere pursuit of health always leads to something unhealthy. Physical nature must not be made the direct object of obedience. It must be enjoyed, not worshipped. Because the earth is kind, we can imitate all of her cruelties." And so we become what we worship. We conform ourselves toward what we consider to be these ultimate goods. We resemble them. We imitate them. With technology is a great thing. It makes our lives easier. But it can also lead to an obsession with control or a disdain for the organic and the tradition. With family, you know, family is a good thing. It has to continue the species. It's a community. But it can also, if we worship it, it can lead to the commodification of children and using your spouse as a means just to procreate or like a consumer product. And health and beauty are always nice, but it can, on the downside, it can lead to a contempt for the sick and the imperfect. So if you worship God, though, everything else kind of falls into the right order. I wanted to say that, too. So why is the fertility industry booming? It's a multi-billion dollar industry and growing more and more every year. It's just growing and growing exponentially. And there's an infertility epidemic. We are in an infertility epidemic. And I would categorize infertility into social and clinical. Social infertility has to do with our behaviors. We're behaving very differently, especially in the last century. The invention of the birth control pill has caused women to just delay and delay and delay childbearing, delaying it so much so that they're aging out of their own natural fertility window. And the quality of a woman's eggs drops dramatically, even as young as age 30. So these women are going on to use egg donors themselves, possibly surrogates, or they're using sperm donors in the rush to have a kid before their fertility window closes. Secondly, gender antagonism. What I mean by that is a mistrust of the opposite sex. And this is a little bit of a result of the divorce revolution. People do not believe they can have a healthy relationship. They don't trust the opposite sex. They are terrified of getting married because they're afraid it's going to lead to divorce. But they really want to be parents. So what they're doing is they're using a sperm or egg donor so that they can be a parent but avoid the relationship, avoid the messiness of a human relationship. And thirdly, we're seeing more alternative sexualities. So I'm mainly talking about same-sex couples here. But as we know, the stigma for same-sex relationships has dropped dramatically over the last few decades. And with that, we've seen this big push for same-sex marriage. But the connection between marriage and children is still very strong in the public imagination. So you have first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes the baby and the baby carriage. Same-sex couples are fulfilling those first two activities. And then they expect they want to have the third one too. But of course, they're going on to use donors for this. So that's behavioral infertility, social infertility. Now, clinical. These are barriers to the body, bodily barriers to reproduction. And you guys may not know this, but sperm count globally has dropped 50% in the last 50 years. Scientists are calling it the feminization of men. There has been a dramatic increase in our pesticide use, our use of plastics, and a whole range of chemicals that they call synthetic estrogens. The birth control pill is a synthetic estrogen, and those get into our bodies, and especially what it disrupts is it gets into a pregnant woman's body, and the developing baby, their endocrine system is sabotaged by these synthetic estrogens, and so you have a baby that doesn't develop, their reproductive parts don't develop normally. The male child will become feminized, and his reproductive future will be at stake. Also, STDs, with female factor infertility, at least 25% of infertile women, they can directly relate their infertility back to an STD. So, we do have an infertility epidemic, and infertility is real, and it's devastating. But we are not fixing infertility. We're not cleaning up our environment, and we're not cleaning up our behavior. Okay? What we're doing is we're taking someone else's child and we're slapping on a new birth certificate and calling it this person's child. We're not curing infertility. So it all starts with straight couples. First, what we did was with heterosexual married couples, we replaced the biological father. We said, biology doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. As long as there's a dad there and he loves the kid and he tucks it in, biology does not matter. And then lesbian couples came in and they said, well, if biology doesn't matter, then why doesn't gender matter? We can raise this kid just as good as any guy can. And after them, you have single moms by choice coming in, and they say, well, if biology doesn't matter and gender doesn't matter, then what does the number of parents matter? And we have successfully disposed of fathers. They are no longer necessary. And this is where children are conceived. The room on the left is called a masturbatorium. And men go in there, and they masturbate into a cup, watching pornography, and then they sign a contract promising to have nothing to do with their offspring. And they charge a fee for this. They're paid about $75, maybe $100. A man can make up to $12,000 per year doing this. The woman on the right you might recognize as Octomom. Her real name is Nadia Suleiman. She is a welfare recipient. There's no father there to support her 14 kids that she has. She's a welfare recipient. She has over $1 million in personal debt. And in 2012, she did an adult film for the money she needed to support her family. Nadia is an extreme example, but she's a very real example of what we're allowing to happen. So what happens when fathers are disposable on a societal scale? Well, we know, we have good data on this. This is solid information. 90% of homeless and runaway youth come from fatherless homes. 90% of repeat arsonists come from fatherless homes. 80% of rapists. 75% of adolescents in chemical abuse centers. And girls who grew up without their father are 711% more likely to become teen moms and 92% more likely to divorce. So let me remind you, now we have an industry that is promoting fatherlessness. They're making money by creating deliberately fatherless kids. Now, can I tell you that donor-conceived kids are going to mirror these same numbers? No, we don't have the research on that. But you tell me that these numbers should not give us cause for concern. So what happens when we remove mothers? Again, it all starts with straight couples. We have infertile women who their eggs are bad, or they can't gestate the baby for whatever reason. So they're using egg donors and surrogate mothers to have children. And they're saying biology doesn't matter. Biology doesn't matter. It's just who raises it, loves it, tucks it in. And, of course, then gay male couples are coming in, and they're using those same arguments. They're saying, you know, if biology doesn't matter, then why does gender matter? We can do all those same things, too. And if biology doesn't matter, if gender doesn't matter, then what does the number matter? Single dads by choice are now using these same technologies. And we are saying, promoting the idea that it's okay to dispose of mothers. And women are becoming breeders, baby machines. In the third world countries, places like India and Thailand, they have women who are desperate for money are submitting to living in factories. I mean, baby factories. There's dormitories where they just, 20 women in a small room, and they keep them there until they've gestated these babies for rich Western couples. The surrogate mothers, they don't have a relationship with the couple. They've never communicated. They don't speak the same language. They're only doing this for money. The male couple at the bottom, they're partly California, partly Australian, but their names are Mark Newton and Peter Trung. And they hired a Russian surrogate, paid her $8,000 to create a little boy. They began abusing this little boy sexually just days after he was born. They created child pornography. They used that pornography to market him as a prostitute within their international pedophile network. And nobody did a background check on them. There's no home studies in any of this, just so you know. And when asked about fatherhood, this is what Mark Newton had to say. He said, "Being a father was an honor and a privilege that amounted to the best 6 years of my life." They even put their little boy on a TV show promoting surrogacy. So what happens when mothers become disposable? Well, childbearing is seen as a lower class service that you can outsource. And this, motherhood, is no longer seen as sacred. The healthcare needs of women. Childbearing is still very risky for women. Our healthcare needs are seen as burdens to the bottom line. You are a vessel, and anything you need is a burden to our pocketbooks. In the short term, you're going to have a lot of health consequences because in egg harvesting and surrogacy, the hormones that they give women are known to have strong associations with cancer. There have been women who have died. There have been women who have had strokes and women who have lost their own fertility because they've been egg donors or surrogates. And in the long term, the worth of femininity and motherhood is just totally undermined. And I just have a little sheet of paper. This is a real contract with the different costs of parts and procedures involved with surrogacy. And a fetal reduction, an abortion, it'll cost the intended parent $500. If the surrogate has to have a hysterectomy, that'll cost you $5,000. If she has to lose an ovary or a fallopian tube, that will cost you $3,500. This is the cost of human life and women's health. It's all right there. Okay. So we know about disposable fathers, disposable mothers. What happens when children become commodities? Well, we are commodities. at this point. The image on the far left is a real egg donor ad soliciting egg donors from you know, Ivy League colleges, and it appeals to a young woman's vanity, and it appeals to her sense of altruism. So notice the word elite and donors. Are you a donor if you're getting paid $100,000 to do something? No, you're not. The advertisement on the right is a advertisement for sperm donors, and they have this good-looking guy, and they say, are you healthy, intelligent, and generous? Well, pass it on. Donate your sperm. So this is an industry. And like any good business person involved in any industry, they're going to try to industrialize the processes, and they're going to try to increase efficiencies. The woman on the bottom, her name is Teresa Erickson. She was a surrogacy attorney in California, and she was the sweetheart of the industry. She had her own podcast. She was, like, famous. She's now a convicted felon. She was convicted for baby selling. But this is what Teresa did wrong. She found her own sperm donors, created embryos with her own egg donors, and implanted those embryos into her own surrogates that she hired. And then when the baby was in the second trimester, considered, solid at that point, then she would go out and find commissioning couples, lie to them and say, hey, we had the first couple backed out. Do you want to take on this contract? And she sold 13 babies for up to $180,000 each. And the only reason she was convicted is because she had all the paperwork signed after conception and implantation, when she should have done it before conception and implantation. The experience for the child is going to be the same. The experience for the parents raising it is going to be the same. So what I'm trying to explain is this is a market in children. Okay. So what are some of the issues that donor-conceived people face? This is my short list. On the top is identity loss. Okay, in the 1970s, there was a man named Alex Haley who wrote a book titled Roots. And it was a best-selling book, and it chronicled his decade-long journey to discover his genealogy. And he was uniquely able to trace his ancestors back to Gambia, where his ancestor Kunta Kinte was kidnapped and trafficked onto a slave ship. And he told the story of his parents, grandparents, all the way back to Kunta Kinte. Haley's book was turned into a TV miniseries, and it became the most watched TV miniseries in American history. It was a huge hit, and it spurred a revolution in family reunions and stressed the importance of knowing whom and where you come from. Haley also wrote the biography of Malcolm X. Malcolm X, of course, is one of our most celebrated civil rights leaders. And the X in his made-up last name is a symbolic statement criticizing the deliberate alienation and removal of a person from their cultural heritage and their biological family. So many of you probably grew up knowing both your biological parents, and this identity is the last thing might be hard, but we have precedence that this is important. We've learned in recent history that this is important, and yet we're doing it all over again with donor-conceived people. Okay. Disenfranchised grief. Donor-conceived people are not allowed to grieve the loss of their biological parents. This is a picture of a real family. We can call the gentleman Tom. Tom was my mom's best friend. And unfortunately, he died of terminal cancer when his two kids were 5 and 7. And when Tom died, the entire community mourned his death. And what the family did was they made videotapes. He wrote letters to the kids. They took a lot of pictures. And they have this beautiful oil portrait of Tom right above the dining room table. So he was honored as the father. I remember my mom, after his death, just crying. And she said, oh, those poor kids, it's so sad that they don't get to grow up with their father. And I just thought that it was pretty ironic because these kids had videotapes and photos and letters and all these amazing things that I didn't have. My point is that kids whose parent dies, they are given the time and the tools and the permission to grieve. Donor-conceived people are not allowed any of those things. Toxic shame. Here's another one. Toxic shame is the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. We deal with toxic shame in two ways. We can withdraw or hide the person, the inadequate person that we think we are, or we can erupt in anger and point all that pain outwards and away. You know, a lot of donor-conceived people, they'll buy the whole, oh, you were so wanted, this is such a happy thing, you know, I'm so happy to be here. Some of us will wander into the shameful reality of our conception. So the masturbatorium, the anonymity, the payment. And it's hard to avoid feelings of shame because there's just so many embarrassing realities, rude realities about the nature of our conception. And in 2009, there was a report called the My Daddy's Name is Donor Report. And in it, it said, it showed that donor-conceived people are actually twice as likely as those raised by their biological parents to report having problems with the law before age 25. And why I think this is all important for society and why everybody should be concerned about this deliberate fatherlessness is because hurt people hurt. A lot of perpetrators and criminals were just once victims. Talking about once victims, the number one predictor of child abuse is a kid living with a non-genetic guardian, especially a non-genetic male. And we're at least 100 times greater risk of lethal abuse by a step-parent, and the risk of non-lethal abuse, like sexual abuse or just neglect, is even higher than that. And this is what motivated me to start speaking out against sperm donation, because the truth is that biology does matter and the quality of care a child receives. And in my experience, the infertile partner, they're never eager to use a sperm donor. What they do is they endure the use of a donor because they don't want their partner to divorce them. They don't want to be abandoned. And again, you know, not all stepdads are bad, but these numbers tell a story. And what troubles me about these numbers, again, is we have a for-profit industry promoting the idea that biology does not matter. I'm very concerned the child abuse rates are going to skyrocket. I'm almost done. I got a couple more. One thing that I'm very concerned about with donor-conceived people is a confusion over what is sacred and what is commercial. So in my situation, I was told from a very early age, age 5, that I was donor-conceived. So this was always normal. That's why I went and sold my own eggs later on. When you're told that it's totally all right to pre-sell and pre-order children, which is what this is, you'll be very confused about other topics that have to do with human value and dignity and just healthy relationships. So why is it okay to buy and sell sperm and eggs and not okay to buy and sell human organs or tissue? Why is it okay to buy and sell sperm and eggs and surrogate wombs? In other words, your reproductive capacities, but not okay to sell your sexual capacities. If it's okay to force a child into existence because it's so wanted, then why is it not okay to force a child out of existence because it's so unwanted? And donor-conceived people are 20 times more likely to go on and sell their own sperm or eggs than the general population. And you know what? You're going to meet donor-conceived people that say they're totally all right with being donor-conceived. They think this is a fantastic way of having a family. But ask them, what else are you okay with? Ask them that. And lastly, genetic sexual attraction and accidental incest. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine, they have some guidelines that suggest a limit of 25 children per donor per population of 800,000. So if you extrapolate that out, that means slightly over 250 offspring per donor within New York City. Over 600 offspring per donor within New York State, almost 10,000 offspring within the U.S., and almost 220,000 offspring internationally. And this is just a suggestion. This is not a hard law. So this is a public health concern. I have friends who have hundreds of siblings. One friend has over 300 half-siblings. I have another acquaintance who's estimated he has almost 1,000 half-siblings. The world is a pretty small place, and if you're living in a city with 250 half-siblings that you don't know, that's a recipe for disaster. That's a public health concern. And with genetic sexual attraction, you know, this idea that opposites attract, might not be true. People are actually very attracted to those that look like them and act like them and like all the same things as them. In other words, people need to know who they're related to. They need to know where they came from for the sake of their actual physical health and for the sake of their mental health. And if you're curious about the images on the right, that's taken from a Korean film called Old Boy. And it's being remade in Hollywood already, I think. But it deals with incest. It deals with shame. We know that incest is a bad thing. Okay, so remember, you guys are the children, and you're going to go out in the world, and you're going to start stating the obvious and exposing the lies. You need to be equipped with the right tools. So the industry, what they're going to say, they're going to use euphemisms. They're going to call a father and a mother a donor. They are going to call the act of selling donating. A birth mother becomes a gestational carrier, and selling your baby becomes giving a gift. They're going to say that being wanted is all that matters and love is all that matters. Please, with the Mark Newton and the Peter Trung slide, I hope I conveyed to you that the idea that being wanted is just not enough. We have to ask a few more questions before we just give a child to someone who says, oh, I want one. Can I have one? Okay? It's not an act of love to pay your child's biological parent to abandon him or her. And they're going to try and normalize this through the pop culture, through celebrities. They even have a show right now called The New Normal, trying to normalize surrogacy, trying to normalize motherlessness. And they're going to say, well, everybody's doing it. There's so many people I know doing it. It's just not a good enough excuse, as you know. One in five couples are now struggling with infertility. I know that you guys know at least one person who struggled with infertility. Probably many of you have yourselves. There are solutions to infertility, but it's going to be a hard battle. Third-party reproduction is not a solution to infertility. It is a marketplace for children, and we don't want to commodify kids. So we're going to have to learn how to grieve our infertility, and you're going to have to learn how to talk to people about this, affirm them, but condemn this act. And it can be really hard to find the right words for that. I know it's tough. That's why I created my website and I published a book. The Anonymous Us Project, I have a website. It's anonymousus.org. And our tagline is, anonymity in donor conception hides the truth, but anonymity in storytelling helps reveal it. And so I have over 200 stories on the website available to read for free from donor-conceived people and donors, parents, adoptees, anybody who's been affected by third-party reproduction. And I also recently just came out with this book. It's a little bit more user-friendly than just reading big blocks of type on a website. So I've got the free resource, and I also have the books available, and I have a robust introduction to the fertility industry and how things are working today, and I also have those testimonials. So when you guys are reaching out to people and trying to be gentle with this very controversial topic, the testimonials hopefully will be a great tool for you. And that's what I do. That's really my presentation. I guess we have some time for questions now. But thank you guys so much for listening.
We have a problem here, so why don't you move to this side? All right, we have some questions. An interesting presentation. Thank you. And some of the questions are similar, so I'm going to try to combine them
Okay. So
that we can get through most of them. Okay. Some of the discussion about biology matters seems to slap the adoption agencies, which are a backbone to pro-life movement. How do we address that? Well, at the same time, someone is asking, how do these statistics regarding non-biological parents impact the outcome of children in traditional adoptions? Once the fees are all paid, is traditional adoption baby selling?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, one that I've grappled with myself. Well, we have to remember not to objectify children. Adoption is an institution that provides parents to existing children that desperately need those parents. Donor conception, as it works today, is a market which creates children for the adults that want them. They become products. That objectification is an important point. And also, we have to realize that adoption history, we've come a long way in the success of adoption. So the orphan train movement, which took orphans from the city and they brought them out to the Midwest. And that was kind of the beginning of adoption in America as we know it. And in the beginning, there was a lot of child abuse. Kids were actually being treated as indentured servants more than anything. And so there was reform that had to be happened within adoption to screen parents, make sure that there was protocol, home studies. A lot of bureaucracy had to be in place to make up for the Cinderella effect, for this truth that biology matters. So what we do now in adoption is we try to find the most emotionally intelligent people we can find, and then we connect them with a child. Right now in donor conception, there's no home studies. There's no they just did a basic criminal background check, but it operates very differently.
That brings up another question about the relationship that you have, and this one's personal, so if you prefer not to answer, that's fine, too. Did you have a relationship with your mother's husband, dad, they put as a question mark, a loving one? What about adoptive children? Neither parent is genetic parent.
Okay, I'll answer the first part for sure. My mom's first husband, they divorced when I was 8, and then I never saw him again. And then my mom remarried, and she said, okay, this is your dad now. And I found our relationship very antagonizing. We had an aversion to each other. And I hear other donor-conceived people saying, oh, I have an aversion to my social father. There's some lucky ones that have great social dads, and they get along great, but it seems to be more difficult to connect.
And this question, do you know who your father is? Like, is there a tracking system?
Right. So the only information I had was that he was this hair color, eye color, and he had a college degree. When I was 19, I got a more full profile. I did some digging, and I was able to get some fill-in-the-blank answers, like he's Polish. He likes scuba diving or something like that. That was almost 10 years ago. No, that was 9 years ago. And I've been searching ever since. I had to make a decision. Do I want to spend a decade of my life searching for this man, or do I want to take those energy and resources and just teach other people about this and try to correct the system a little bit? And I chose I'm going to write about it and try to correct the system a little bit. And through my writing, I connected with a pro bono private investigator who she just gets a kick off of this puzzle work. And she just, I mean, her brain works in magical ways. She started all these Excel spreadsheets. She's a hacker. She was hacking into government databases. And now I'm 95% sure I know who the guy is. I emailed his 2 kids, but they're working it over. They haven't responded to me yet. It's a long answer.
Is there much data on motherless homes or children? We've seen much data on fathers, they're saying, but what about the motherless? Because you brought that up.
Right. Well, it used to be if a child's mother died, their own mortality was then at risk. I don't know any good research papers that have like clear, like these are the psychological outcomes, but we culturally, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Culturally, we know that the greatest pain a child can have is not having its mother. I don't have any specifics on, like, psychological outcomes, though.
Yeah, I think it's relatively new. You can guarantee that as more homosexuals raise children, we'll start seeing more study on that particular question. But to have deliberate motherless homes is a new phenomenon, so I'm not surprised that you haven't been able to find a lot of data on that. Yeah. How accurate was the recent movie with Vince Vaughn?
Oh, Delivery Man.
Delivery Man, yes.
Sure. I actually really liked that movie. I thought it was much more of an accurate portrait than The Kids Are All Right. They treated the donor-conceived people in the film as real human beings with problems and issues. And he's got hundreds of offspring, and I know people with hundreds of half-siblings, so that was real. I prefer the Canadian version that film derives from. There's a French-Canadian original called Starbuck. The casting was just much more better done. But it is actually a fairly pro-fatherhood film. And there's redemption. He realizes the errors of what he did. And in the end, he proposes marriage to the woman who's, like, she just gave birth to their child. And then he proposes to her. So it's... It, resolves on the intact family. So I actually really like that movie.
Well, let's see where they go with that. We've seen where the entertainment industry gets involved in something, makes it really funny and cute, and next thing we know, it is normalized.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. I don't watch movies for that very reason. Here is another question. I went through 18 cycles of donor artificial insemination, had one miscarriage, ended up adopting a little boy. I would have cut off my right arm for a baby. My Catholic priest didn't know, would object, but another minister said it was fine. Do clergy still believe this is okay now? This was over 20 years ago.
Wow.
Have you sent your materials to these clergymen? I guess them either.
Well, I mean, John Paul II knows it's wrong. Clergy themselves, I'm just going through RCIA myself right now in Northern California.
I'll be doing that too.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Yay.
So Easter will be together.
Yes. Very excited. The priest at my parish, I tried to talk to him about this, and he didn't get it.
It's new. That's why this is so critical. This is so critical. And what the Cleveland Right to Life has done for our lives to bring this type of information is just incredible. What you're doing is just commendable. And being so young, my, we have to make sure you're covered in prayer. How has it being a donor recipient negatively impacted your past and present life?
Right, so I wasn't a recipient. I was an egg donor. Is that what you mean? I guess that's what you mean. So I sold my eggs at age 20. There's two genetic offspring out there. I did it as open identity so that they could track me later on when they wanted. That was my way of bucking the system, And it was the only activity I could engage in knowingly that my father had also done. So it was a way of attempting poetry and following in his footsteps, so to speak. It's impacted me. I don't write and speak about it a lot right now because the implications are going to be heaviest probably a couple decades from now. So I don't want to give any conclusions about it until I've met the kids and I see how they've turned out. But I have a 2-year-old daughter, and then I have a little boy on the way, and what you realize is that what you're doing impacts other members of your family. So you get so caught up in the money, because they give you thousands of dollars, it might as well be $1 million with when you're that young. You get caught up, you know, what am I going to do with this money? How is this money going to be better for my life? And you see one half step ahead, and you don't realize how's that going to affect my future kids. What's my husband going to do when these kids come and kind of invade our home life? We'll see.
All right. We only have time for one more question. So the other two questions that I can't get to, you can ask later. You'll be here to sign books and help us out through more information. This has just been incredible, Alana. Thank you for sharing yourself. And so personally, this is something that I pray the Lord gives you great rewards for, especially as you're on your pilgrimage to Catholic. How do you feel about single parent adoption?
That's tough. You know, ideally every kid would have a mother and a father. I worry for the kid's safety if that mother were to bring in a stepdad. I worry about the financial constraints, you know, as she's providing for the family, is she going to even be that available as a mother for the kid? I guess it depends on the situation, but obviously, preferably the kid would have the two. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's give Alana another hand. It's just, wow.
You have been listening to Alana Newman, founder of the Anonymous Us Project and 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.